Welcome to Trapping Across America. I'm Chip Davis, and I'm sitting in tonight for Clint. Clint is at a couple of conventions for this week and next week, so I am going to be sitting in for him and taking care of the show duties for tonight and also for next week is the plan. Many of you that listen to Trapping Across America heard me called out in front of thousands of trappers all across the United States last week by Clint when he was telling you that he was going to be out, and he kind of put me on the spot, which is fine. Clint and I pick at each other all the time. He's a great guy, and I'm more than happy to help. And good luck to you, Clint, at the shows, and be safe in your travels. And convention season is here, guys. There's conventions all over starting up, and between now and fall, there'll be certainly a convention somewhat close to you. And I'd encourage you to get out and go visit these things. Boy, there's a wealth of knowledge there. Vendors, everything you can think of at these shows, and demos, just full of knowledge for everything from, oh wow, just from turtles to coyotes and everything you can think of in between. Most of these conventions do a super, super good job at getting speakers and presentations and demos together from some of the top names all around the country and just about anything you can imagine. So there's a lot of stuff to be learned from these. And so stop by there, find you one close to you, and just go to it. If you've never been to a convention, you're in for a real treat. If you have been to one or multiples, you know how much fun it is and how much value there is in these things. Clint, actually, this week is going to be at the Pennsylvania Trappers Association Rendezvous. It is Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, the 18th, 19th, and 20th of June. For more information and directions on that, you can go to patrappers.com. That's patrappers.com. Look that up, and Clint's going to be his booth. Predator Control Group is Clint's booth. He'd love to see you and shake your hand. He's going to be in the main building at the convention center there, and he's actually going to be putting on a real interesting portable pocket demo. The title of the demo is Portable Pocket Use from Muskrats to Coyotes. So stop by there, meet Clint if you don't know him, visit with him, take a look at his products. He's got some super good stuff there, and if you get a chance, stop by there and catch his demo. You'll learn a lot, I guarantee you that. Next week, Clint's leaving Pennsylvania, and he's actually going to LaGrange, Indiana, to the Fur Takers of America convention, the FTA. That show is Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, June 25th, 26th, and 27th. He also will have his Predator Control Group booth there at that show. I tried to look that up and could not find the exact building, but you won't have any trouble finding him when you get there. Not sure about if he's going to be putting demos on there or not at that show, but he certainly will be there and would love for you to stop by the booth, chat with him for a few minutes, take a look at his lures and his products and what he's got there. Clint's a super good guy, wealth of knowledge. They also, in LaGrange, Indiana, at the FTA, will have a full slate of demos there, and there'll be a wide range, just about anything that you're trapping or chasing in the woods. There'll be somebody with some expertise there, and you can talk to them and just gain a pile of knowledge right there. That's my takeaway every time I go to one of these shows or conventions or rendezvous, ever what you call them. My takeaway from all of them is how much knowledge is there, and if you just kind of make yourself a sponge and soak up as much of it as you can, it'll be a real valuable tool for you. It'll be stuff that you can use not only immediately this fall when you start trapping, or it'll be stuff that you can use for the rest of your life on your trap line. Just the knowledge base I'm talking about. In addition to that, you meet a lot of cool guys too. Some of my really super good friends to this day I've met at trapping conventions. Actually, my plan is to host Trapping Radio again next week, and my plan is to interview a guy. He does not have a trapping business per se, as far as retail sales of any kind of product. He's just a trapper, but he's an awesome guy. He's super interesting. He runs a huge snare line, does super good on that, and my plan is to interview him next week on Trapping Radio and talk to him about that. So make sure and stay tuned in. It's got actually a lot of twists and turns there, and he runs a big snare line and does things quite a bit different than I've ever heard anybody else do. And I've certainly learned tons from him about catching coyotes, especially in snares. So that'll be something fun to look forward to and listen to. I'm certainly looking forward to doing that interview. So I'm just going to kind of throw that teaser out there and encourage you to tune in next week as well. And we will cover a lot. I promise you, you'll learn something new about snaring coyotes if you listen to that show too. Tonight, we have a good show. Now, this is the first time ever I've hosted Trapping Radio for 3 or 4 episodes now. I think maybe this is my third one, actually. I've been a guest on it being interviewed by Clint another time or two. So this is my first solo act here. So be patient with me a little bit. I'm still kind of learning my way around the ropes at Trapper Radio and where all the right buttons are and getting used to the mobile studio, if you will. So it's a lot of fun. I enjoy doing it, and I appreciate your patience with me as you let an amateur try to lead you through an hour-long podcast here. And we actually may be a little bit more brief than that, a little shorter time period tonight, and I'll explain that here in a second. But I do have a good show for you, I think. You know, there's a lot of guys that can tell you a lot more about catching coyotes or catching coons or catching fox than I can. I guess my one area of expertise, and you've probably heard it on this show if you listen to it for any length of time, my son and I actually own Expandapan. We're a relatively new company that makes the big trap pan, so we've done a lot of testing on these and a lot of research, and that's kind of the gist of the show that I wanted to bring you. I think maybe that what I found, some of these facts and figures can help you. I'm going to try my best to do this so it's not an infomercial for Expandapan. We'll be using a lot of Expandapan analogies and comparisons because all this research and all the testing that we did was to develop Expandapan and to try to make a good product. So there's no way to really explain all of my research without mentioning my company, because that's why it was all done. It's almost an integral part that depends on each other. So I'm going to try my best to stay away from infomercial. I'm not here specifically plugging this. I will say this, there's a couple other guys out there that are making big trap pans. There's also Clint's even got a YouTube video on how he made his own, some homemade versions of these. That's online. I know it's a YouTube, or at least it used to be a YouTube video of that up. It was free, and Clint actually in the early days made a lot of his out of electrical knockout boxes, and that's really, I'll be honest and tell you how that started. That's kind of where my idea started from, this what he was doing and how kind of we improved on that. But competition is a good thing, so I'm not knocking any of my competition. I would just ask you, if you're interested in big pans, look around, see what's out there, compare, shop. We got a really cool website that we're real proud of that we just got through putting together several months ago. It's www.expandapantraps.com. www.expandapantraps.com. So all of our products are on there, and hopefully that's about as far as advertisement as I'll go, but we'll be mentioning Expandapan as we go on. Before I really get started and get in the meat of the show, I want to tell you, I'm recording this show right now sitting in a motel room in Memphis, Tennessee. And I got a little non-trapping personal note, I guess, that I want to kind of share with you guys and tell you a little bit about where I'm at right now. And so I've got two sons. Bailey, I think I already mentioned, is my oldest son, and he's my partner in Expandapan. It's just the two of us that put this company together. We've got some really unique equipment that we're manufacturing these trap pans and various other trapping products on too. And so my Bailey, my oldest son, and I are partners in there. And you know, we do all that. Bailey's fingerprints are on every single Expandapan that goes out our doors, and so his presence is also there online on our website as well. But I also have another son. I have a 11-year-old son that was born in October of 2003. We call him as a nickname K, and the K stands is short for killer, and he was nicknamed that after his early deer hunting successes and his early deer hunting career when he was, oh, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years old. Seems like every time we took him on the quote-unquote child deer hunts, he would score almost. So it didn't take long for the name killer, and then we call him K for short, and it kind of stuck almost. And the other reason is he loves to trap too. My whole family loves to trap and traps and trapping and the whole gamut of what we all love to do. And I'm assuming that everyone listening to the show has that passion, or else they probably wouldn't be tuned into a trapping podcast on a Friday night. But yeah, so Kay loves to trap, and he is my dispatch man. He's 11 years old. He's my dispatch guy when we catch coons and possums and skunks. He loves to operate the 22 and do what's necessary to do when we catch those, and that's his specialty. He can work the 22 faster than Butch Cassidy, I think. So at any rate. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about when he was born back in 2003. My wife actually was a labor and delivery nurse at the time, and he was born in the very hospital where she worked. So why that's important is we kind of had the inside scoop on with all the doctors and nurses, and they were all friends of ours. And so when Kay was born, it was just a lot of fun. All of her friends there, who were also my wife's colleagues when she wasn't pregnant and actually delivering other people's babies, she was there, and everybody joked and carried on. At any rate, when Kay was born, our pediatrician and my wife's doctor walked in, and immediately we looked at them, and the look on their face were, I guess I would describe it as, very somber grimaces, I suppose. And they were usually joking and laughing, like I said, but the instant they walked in that hospital room, and I'll remember it forever, I knew something was bad wrong. I knew something had not gone exactly right, and I wasn't sure what. So first, they told us that there was a suspicious bump about the size of, say, a lemon cut in half. And this bump was under the skin on our son's back. And they explained to us that what that meant is it's most likely a birth defect they call it spina bifida. And I guess I had heard that term before and knew it was a infant pregnancy kind of defect, but I wasn't even exactly sure what it was. And so they started explaining that to us, and they told us that it would be affecting nerves of some sort, or at least there's a large probability of that, that were going to the lower half of our child's body. This actual bump, they call it was in the lower part of his back, and so with any spina bifida, as I understand it, from wherever the point on the spine is that the nerves are entailed, the affected area is from there down. It can be high, it can be low. So at any rate, they told us, the doctors, as they were explaining this to us, they told us that they had a helicopter already en route from our state children's hospital. It was on the way. They sat down with tears in their eyes, and they told us to kind of get ourselves ready and prepare ourselves, because there's a really good chance that child would never walk and be in a wheelchair for all of his life. And so, fast forward several days later, we were at our children's facility about 100 miles away from where we live and where he was born, and Kay went through just a major league spinal cord surgery to untether the nerves that were involved in what the doctors were calling this myelomeningocele, or this the spina bifida area that was affected. The surgery was a huge success to us, and the doctors all explained to us that we'd really have to wait and see which individual nerves were involved and where those nerves were supposed to have gone, and the ones that they couldn't reattach, then those are the question marks, and we just didn't know. Were these going to the leg muscles? Were they going to, where were they going? So you got thousands of nerves coming through your spine, and they all have a predestined place that they go, and just a few of his didn't go to the right spots when he was developing. So several months later, he learned to walk, then he learned to run, and he was, I guess, just well on his way to growing up. And all that time, my wife and I, we're still just kind of unsure which nerves had been involved in this spinal bifida condition. We were fully aware that We were not pushing a wheelchair. So anything else did not matter. We were just so thankful, and we'll be eternally grateful that God answered our prayers. We actually pray for two things. We pray that God's will be done in this situation and that we would not be selfish about that at all. And we also pray that God just would not allow us to would not put more on us than we can handle at the time. Now, those were our two prayers, and they were absolutely answered. And you know, as things came up and issues came up, we just reminded ourselves, hey, you know what? We're not pushing a wheelchair, so everything's going to be okay. Well, a few years later, it did become apparent where those nerves should have gone, and it was gone. They were supposed to have gone to his bowel and bladder sensations or functions there, and we've kind of figured out that our issue with our child's condition would be bowel and bladder incontinence, and that's really not a big deal. Both of them can be, you know, relatively easily addressed, and we learned, and my son learned to do self-administered catheters to stay dry multiple times every day. He's a trooper with that. He thinks about that no different than, you know, quote unquote normal people would think about using the restroom any other way. As far as the bowel issues, they were easily treated with daily enema treatments, and they kind of take care of the rest of the bowel issues. So I just got through earlier mentioning that I'm in a motel room in Memphis, and the reason that I'm in Memphis is this motel happens to be in the shadows of Le Bonheur Children's Hospital. Awesome facility for, you know, if you're ever faced with something like this. People are so friendly, and Kay just went through a surgery to kind of rearrange some bowel plumbing that will allow him to do his daily treatments by himself. Up till now, he's had to kind of rely on mom and dad to put tubes in places that tubes never were intended to go, and that's been okay. Like I said, he's 11 years old. He's a trooper. He handles it great, no problems whatsoever. But there's some technology that became available and surgery that could be done that we elected to do, kind of rearrange some plumbing, and just is going to give him a whole bunch of more of independence and almost really a new lease on life. He can no longer, or we're going to have to put tubes in real uncomfortable places and do things just for daily treatments. He can do a lot of that himself and be a lot more comfortable kind of thing. So what I would ask you to do is this. I'm a praying kind of guy. I believe in that. I think it's a super powerful resource, and if you were inclined to do so, we would ask you to join us just to kind of pray for a speedy recovery for him, and hopefully by trapping season everything will be all healed up and taken care of. It's a pretty major abdominal surgery that we just went through, and things appear to have gone super well with it. A little bit of trouble, slow waking up, and some issues today, but we're well on our way, and he just needs some heal. So we got healing time, so we got several weeks of that in front of us, but hey, it's gonna be okay. So all that is going to be good. Changing gears real briefly, I want to talk about something else that happened the last couple of days. You know, our 11-year-old son, my trapping buddy, is, you know, he just had a major surgery. And to be honest, it's something that our family have both looked real forward to and also that we dreaded for a long time. And I'll explain both of those. We really look forward to those because of the independence it was going to give him, the, you know, better lifestyle it was going to give him, the more things he could do on his own, and really it's an independence kind of thing when it's all boiled down. The dread side is you don't like to see your little boys having trouble breathing because he's coughing. He just went through a major surgery. You kind of, you know, feel sorry for yourself. Maybe I did, knowing that you were going to have to watch him be put to sleep and tubes shoved down his throat and completely under. And I was really feeling sorry for myself late last night, almost midnight, when they were bringing him out of surgery. And boy, he just kind of looked rough there. And that was the dread part. So I was probably wallowing in the dread more than I was looking, you know, focused on the positive or looking forward to mode. At any rate, that's kind of where we were, where I was as we were coming into this surgery, is I was kind of, you know, thinking about more of the dread than I was the positives that could happen. So when we got to this facility, to Le Bonheur a couple of days ago, staff took us to a room, to our room, where my son still is right this second. And on the trip up there, things kind of started to change for me. I saw some stuff that really kind of brought things home, and I thought was really worthy of mention. I know this doesn't have anything to do with trapping. We're going to get there real quick, I promise you. On the way up there, we saw lots of kids with bald heads. They're probably facing cancer of some way or another. Saw a lot of kids with illnesses I'll never know. Saw some kids in wheelchairs that have probably always been there, probably always will be. I saw one little boy at lunch today that had a halo brace on that was screwed into his skull. Looked almost like, I'm not being tried or making fun of this, but it almost looked like he had a skinning shed on a skinning pole on the top of his wheelchair with a 7x7 3/16 cable there that was attached to this halo that was there to ensure that his cervical spine wouldn't go down. I mean, this is major stuff. Hey, I feel so blessed, so incredibly blessed, and so incredibly lucky, and also so incredibly ashamed for dreading what we were about to face when I see these other kids and what they're going through. So kind of trying to tie this back into the trapping, folks, I think there's really a life lesson here. You know, regardless of how bad we think we have it, and regardless of how bad things seem at the time, there's always somebody and there's always a situation that's worse than what we're dealing with. I know personally so many times I get lost in that, and I think it's really important to remember it's kind of a shame that we got to see something like, you know, like a kid in a halo brace to realize that, and I wish that I personally could do, and I think it's the same for a lot of my buddies and probably a lot of the guys listening to this, I wish I could do a better job of appreciating that every day. And I think that lesson, if you want to take that even a little bit further, applies to a lot of areas in life, not just about sick kids. I think it can apply to work. I think it even can apply to trapping. I've seen times that, hey, you know what? Things weren't going good. My catch wasn't what I wanted. Was not what I wanted it to be. And you know, you just kind of start trying to, make some almost irrational decisions when some of that type of thing comes up. And sometimes it's really good to step back and say, hey, you know what? This is not as bad as it could be. It absolutely is not. I've seen that a lot of times used as excuses for not doing stuff. And I can't do this or I can't do that. But you know what? Most of us listening to this show tonight live in the United States of America. We're the most fortunate and the most blessed nation on the whole entire planet. We're a free people, and we can do, by golly, we can do anything we want to do, whatever that is for an individual person. If that's out-of-state trapping trip, if that's an out-of-state hunting trip, if that's a new career pathway, if that's what a different way to run a snare line, if that's a different way to run a coyote line, whatever it is, with enough determination and enough hard work, anything at all is possible. So I'm going to kind of start tying that whole thought process kind of back into trapping, and we're going to get in these big pans here in just a second, I promise. I got to give you a little bit of history about how I started and how I kind of got into trapping early and then later. I started trapping in the mid-80s, I guess, when I was in high school. And the only reason is just really a freak accident that I even started trapping. My family farmed, and we had a lot of farmland scattered around, and I guess you would at the time have considered us big farmers. We had 1,500 acres that we were working, and there was one trapper that I knew of. There may have been more, but I only knew of one guy. His name was Mr. James, and he asked my dad permission to trap on our place. Well, Dad allowed him to trap, but he knew how outdoorsy I was and how much I liked to hunt and be outside, and so he kind of did me a favor, my dad did, and he asked Mr. James, he said, yeah, sure, you can trap on the place, but he said, would you mind taking my son here? And I, like I said, I was in high school, I just got my driver's license, I was 15 years old, and so he lined it up, and I started meeting Mr. James, and I watched him set his traps, and he started teaching me some basic sets and kind of what we were doing, and I just absolutely fell in love with trapping. That went on good. Well, again, it was this is the mid-1980s. This is immediately before the fur crash. Fur was bringing good prices right back then. Finally, I was actually making some money doing something I could be outside doing and just having an absolute blast. The very first truck I ever bought, I bought with trapping money. I bought, you know, a lot of stuff back then when you're a 15-year-old kid and all of a sudden, you know, fur is worth something, you're catching a lot, the world changes, it seems like. Well, wasn't long after that that we saw the fur crash. You know, also at the time, one thing that's kind of worthy of noting is information was hard to come by. I don't know that there's any way I could have got started as quickly as I had without somewhat of a mentor, and that's what Mr. James did for me. He was kind of a mentor. He showed me some stuff. He got me up and going, and from there, it just, you know, I tried to learn something new every day. But after the fur crash, you know, things kind of changed a little bit. I went off to school, to college, and fur was just, if you were looking at it strictly from a monetary reason and not the enjoyment of being out there, it was kind of hard to justify it, to be honest with you. And so I got out of trapping briefly, but I never did lose the passion. The passion was always still there. Excuse me, I had to take a swig of water here. And from time to time, I still told my trapping stories. When I'd get around buddies, or, you know, say we'd have somebody over to cook supper or something, a lot of times I'd be telling trapping stories from back in my high school and early college days. And by that time, my oldest son had come along, and he heard me telling these stories, and he told me one day, he said, "Dad, I'd like to try that trapping stuff. It sounds like you had fun back then. Why don't we start that?" And wasn't long before Christmas, so for that year for Christmas, I got him a half a dozen leg holes, and we started trapping again. And also, trying to kind of relearn my tricks from back in the 80s, and, you know, we're 30 years down the road now, but I started looking around, and all of a sudden, now we've got the internet, and now we've got YouTube, and I found Clint, he's got such a huge footprint on the internet. I found a lot of his material. I found this very show, Trapper Radio. You know, at this time, back in the 80s, we didn't have a lot of coyotes in the area that I lived in. We caught a few, and there were some here, but there were so few of them, they were so smart, that they were kind of the prize animal. If you could catch a coyote, you could catch anything, was what a lot of the guys said back then. So I never forgot that, and I really wanted to learn coyotes. That was my goal, and that's what I wanted to do. So I started looking for every shred of information to help me with coyotes and help me learn, you know, how to catch them and how they think and what goes through their heads and that sort of thing. So I stumbled across Clint, and as a result of that, I saw he had something called Trapper Radio, and not long after that, I became pretty much, I guess, what you'd call an avid listener to the show, and I ran across an episode of Trapper Radio called Trap Like a Child, or Every Trapper Should Trap Like a Child, something very, very similar to that. It was Trapper Radio 95, I think, and when I listened to that show, I probably listened to that particular episode no less than 30 times, maybe closer to 50, and it absolutely, that one episode changed the very way that I thought and I think today. It literally changed my approach almost to life itself. If you've not listened to that particular episode of Trapper Radio, I would highly encourage you to take a look at the archives, find Trapper Radio 95, Trap Like a Child, and listen to it. Or perhaps, as I do from time to time, re-listen to it. You know, I've listened to it tons of times. And when I originally heard 95, I was getting really kind of burned out on what I was doing in my profession. I was, you know, learning a lot about trapping. We kind of shifted gears and really kind of putting some stuff together. I was ready for a change of pace. And so part of what that show did for me was kind of free my mind up to think and make better longer term decisions, and just kind of almost to allow me to take better control of my own life and my own direction. And so, you know, up to now, a couple of years later, after that episode has aired, I'm still farming, and I'm still doing some of the same things that I was then. But I'm also, you know, fully engaged in my passion for trapping. I've rearranged some things. You know, I still have farming as a major source of my income, but it's really in a completely different approach as to what I had before. So really, to appreciate a lot of that, you'd almost need to go back and listen to 95 if you've not. But that was a super show that Clint put on, and I can't say enough about it. You know, as a result of that, now I've rearranged some things and changed some focuses around. I'm trapping a lot more than I was. I'm able to do things now that, you know, that I love to do with the people I love to do them with. I mean, I love to trap. I love to do it with my boys. I love to get out there, spend time together. You know, that's kind of what it is. My point is this. guys and girls, anybody, anywhere can do or be anything they want to. You know, it's a mindset. And just like I was trying to explain after listening to this Trapping Radio, there's, you know, I didn't know much about Cody's before that, and I wanted to learn it. Even it's almost a two-threaded kind of sentence there, because I also didn't really fully appreciate how to think and some different things that kind of opened up with Trapper 95, and why do we have to accept the status quo out there? Why does it always have to be a black or white? Sometimes it can be gray. Sometimes the right move can be in the middle, and so those are all tailored for each of your individual situations. But just use your head, learn to think, and that's what I love so much about trapping. Is this a thinking man's game? It really is. As a result of that, when I first started, I wanted to catch a coyotes. I actually wanted to catch 100 coyotes. That was my goal. And because of the info that's out there, a lot of it free, a lot of it super cheap, i.e. free is a lot of free content out there on the internet and other places. There's a lot of super cheap content out there. It's probably a little better quality content, but on DVDs, there's hundreds of them out there. Clint's got tons of them out there, so all that's good stuff. And you can learn so much from those, and that's for what little bit the DVD cost, and you can replay that thing hundreds of times and watch it on your own TV in your own living room, and that information does not go away. Once you have that in your head, you got it from then on. So, I was able to achieve my goal of the 100 coyotes, and we've surpassed that and doing way, way more. So, maybe you want to trap and hunt, somewhere different, like I said, or maybe you want to start a new business or whatever goals it is that you want to achieve. If you work hard and you got enough determination, you could do anything you want to. So that's my main point about that. Now, switching gears again a little bit, part of a result of all that learning and all that, like I mentioned, I started following Clint, and he was talking one day about a problem he was having, and that was, he actually hit the nail on the head of some things that I was seeing on my own trap line. I was noticing some pattern misses. We were focusing on coyotes there. I'm going to talk a lot about coyotes because that was what I was focusing on then. It's what I was trying to learn. It's what my goal was. At the time, I was still trying to catch the 100th coyote. So that's what I was focusing on trying to do. And I started seeing these tracks in the pattern. I started seeing tracks inside the jaws of my trap, but not on the pan of my trap. And this is multiple times. This is enough that I realized, hey, this is a problem. I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do. I'm getting the coyote there, and I'm missing him by half an inch. I'm missing him by a quarter of an inch. He's stepping inside the jaws, but he is not triggering my trap pan. He's not stepping on the pan. And about the same time, that's when I saw Clint doing what he was doing with his electrical knockouts. He's basically expanding the pan. I said, hey, you know what? That's a super idea. That's what I need to do. I need to make my pans bigger, and that would eliminate these inside the jaw pattern misses, is what I was thinking. That's the kind of how my mind was working at that time. So I started to research all of that, and I started kind of looking at some of the histories of all that. And as much as I'd love to say that I was the guy with the original big pan idea, I certainly am not. Like I said, we saw a problem, and then we saw someone else having the same problem, and I simply started researching a solution for that. When I saw Clint doing electrical knockouts, that was an idea. It wasn't long after that I got my hands on some of the old Craig O'Gorman tapes that were actually taped back in the mid-80s. It was 30 years later when I was watching those, and some of those Craig was talking about big pans that he was using on traps and how he was making those, and he actually was fooling with he was making for his own use some big pans there. What he wound up doing was going to the very, very stiff wire screens that a lot of basically do the same thing in a lot of regards to solve the same problem. His problem was the same. His solution he wound up on was slightly different. But O'Gorman was talking about this in the 80s. on those tapes where O'Gorman was talking about the need for expanding your pans, he also mentioned some articles that from his research that he had seen from back in the 1920s about trappers expanding the surface area of their pans. And some of those 1920 articles that O'Gorman even referenced, those articles referenced some the same problems that trappers were having dating all the way back to the turn of the century and even the late 1800s. So this idea of expanded pan or a big pan is absolutely nothing new. It is not an original idea that we came up with, as much as I would like to, for it to have been. There were a lot of guys that were smarter than me that came along before me that had the original idea. So kind of like the information age we live in, you know, we've got more technology now, more tools, more way of making these products, and so that's kind of what we decided to do. So we're going to talk a lot about the pans and the big pans and how they can help you, and what we found with them. And there's a lot of stuff I can't tell you. I can't tell you my exact tolerances. I can't give you my exact cut paths and cut sheets on how we make each individual pan. But I can talk a lot in the generalities and what it does, and kind of the ins and outs of what we do. In short, I think that the larger pans put one more advantage in the trapper's corner. And we do this by enlarging the kill area of the trap. To quote Clint, and I shouldn't even try to, I remember on one of the YouTube videos he had up back some years ago, he made the comment that he hoped that his competition would be using regular pans on traps in comparison to him using the big, huge pans he put. I think he was using CDRs at the time. He definitely knew, didn't think he knew, that was going to give him a huge advantage because he had more surface area. It's almost to the degree of adding more traps, just because he had so much more place for that bobcat that he was targeting to put his foot versus maybe his competition that had a much smaller area. It's just basically, you know, making the trigger area of that trap just huge, much larger than what it is as it comes from the factory. So one of the biggest questions that we get, and probably one of the most non-understood problems about the big pans, and one that's the issues that's cited by many people that are not in the big trap pan camp, or not supporters of this, is the issue of toe catches. And it's a issue that at first glance would seem to make a lot of sense. You know, after we got so many questions about this, I decided to try to find some way, somehow, to document what happens. And like I said, at first glance, you would seem to want to say if the pan or the kill area or the trigger or that trap, we're talking about the pan is the kill area or is the trigger, is what the animal has to step on, obviously, to fire the trap. But if that extended all the way to the jaws of the trap, similar to what we're doing with expanded pans, then you would think that the animal could step, say, half on the jaw of the trap and half on the pan itself, trigger the trap, and his foot's way out on the edge, and you would, common sense, logic, a lot of times would have you to think that he was going to have toe catches. He's going to get caught by a toe. So that's the argument that a lot of guys that are not fans of the bigger pans, that's what they think. And that's rightfully so. At arm's length, you would think that was happening. What we were seeing when we started making these and we were testing them was we were not seeing any toe catches. And I kind of scratched my head a little bit. So I was determined to come up with some kind of way to figure this thing out. The other thing I was thinking early, before we realized that, hey, the toe catches just were not happening, was I thought, well, you know, I'd rather have a toe catch than no catch. So that's kind of my first idea, but that never even played out because we just were not get percentage based. We were not getting enough toe catches we were not getting any more than we were getting in the days before we started using big pans. It was actually, you know, very, very similar. If anything, we were getting less toe catches with the big pans than we were before when we were using stock pans on all the traps that we were trapping with. So what we actually came up with about the same time that all this happened, I actually traded smartphones of all things, and the new iPhone came with a slow motion camera built into it. So I said, hey, this may kind of answer some questions as to what's happening here. So I kind of played with my technology a little bit, and I kind of made a little bracket from my smartphone to lean against and on a table, and I made a little fake trap bed out of some one bys on the top of a table, and I've got some video of this stuff that I'll show and I'll have on our website hopefully by fall. Right now I just have not had a chance to edit this and get it up, but I will have that up soon. But I set the phone's camera to slow motion status. I set a trap. I was using actually Bridger number 3 Dogless, which is what I've been trapping live market coyotes in a lot here lately. And I had an expander pan on it. And I found a stick that had a strange kind of flat fork at the bottom of the stick. And that fork, the way it kind of palmated out almost, was very similar to the size of a coyote's foot. It was, if you imagine seeing a coyote track, that's about what the bottom of the stick was. It was actually a green limb when I cut it, and when I saw that fork, I said, hey, that's going to be my coyote's foot. That's going to be what I use to fire this trap. So I hit record, and I recorded countless videos of this trap firing. And what I would do, I would take that stick with the that was the same shape as a coyote's foot, and I would place it half on the jaw of the trap and half on the pan, the expander pan, and I would fire the trap. And so the foot pad of the stick is half on and half off the jaw of the trap. So, and what we found is more than 80% of the time, the trap caught the stick and caught it almost center or just off center of the jaw spread of the trap when the trap closes, if you follow what I'm saying. What happens was this, and it really became apparent and easy to see in the slow motion footage. What happened was that the trap fired, two things were happening simultaneously. The animal's foot, or in our case, my stick, was, even though I was applying down pressure on it, the force of that those jaws, as they were firing, thinking slow motion, with that the foot or pad of the coyote, I'm just going to use this for example, was basically thrown into the air for an inch or two, but it wasn't thrown straight up. It was thrown just the way the jaws were going. It was up and in toward the center line of the trap. So, and at the same time that this was happening, the trap was actually launching into the air somewhat as the trap fired. You had inertia that forces that trap up. So both the trap is traveling upwards slightly, half inch or so, just roughly, and the animal's foot is also being thrown up into the air and toward the center. Well, when both of those happening at the same time, and with the real animal not expecting the trap to fire, and I'm going to come back and cover that in just a second, we were catching this animal lots of times, or in my case the stick, in midair. And I say midair, I'm talking about probably 2 inches above, ground level. You get outside your trap bed, what would be, if you just put a ruler across there, we were catching the animal on what would have been, you would have thought would have been a toe catch, on the outside fire of the pan. We were catching him back in the center of the trap because his foot was being thrown toward the middle, the trap was coming up, and we were basically closing everything up and locking the trap down as the trap is suspended inch or a half inch or so, 3/4 inch, it just depends on the time we threw it, but it's suspended in the air. So I think you can kind of see what's happening here is with the animal not expecting it, he doesn't have time to react, and all of a sudden all of the physics are working in your favor. You're moving your target, i.e. the animal's foot, into the air at the same time the trap's coming up, and you're catching him, regardless of him, instead of him pushing the trap pan straight down and everything being a downward reaction, you're actually catching him on the upbeat, or as the trap and his foot are both going up instead of down. So it's kind of goes against what I would have really thought at the start, but that's what we saw with our slow motion cameras. Another real interesting thing on this part, and I'll give you a little tip, and it's a fun little game to play, might let you win a quarter from your buddy, but this is going to kind of just illustrate what animals' brains do and what our brains do and how slow in real time we are to react to something. I love to show people this example. I do this at shows quite often when I'm explaining this very thing, when we take our booth to these kind of shows or conventions. But lay a quarter on a table and have someone hold their hand above that quarter say 6 inches or so, anywhere from 4 inches to 10 inches above it, but I usually do about 6 inches. I just take his hand, hold it flat, and say, just hold your hand in midair directly above this quarter. I'll take my hand and I'll put in midair above his hand. I'll put my hand over it about, say, 6 inches on top of his hand. So now, if his hand is 6 inches above the tabletop, above the quarter, my hand is 12 inches above the tabletop, 6 inches above his, and here's the deal. It's going to be a race to grab the quarter. The only rule is he cannot move his hand that's closer to the quarter. You know, mine's twice as far. Mine's 12 inches from the quarter. His hand's 6 inches from the quarter. He cannot move his hand until I start. When I start moving my hand, he sees my hand moving, he's free to grab the quarter. I will pick it up every single time. The reason is because he doesn't know exactly when I'm going to move. When I move, I'm way faster. That's what a little bit, if you want to kind of stretch your brain a little bit, the animal does not know that that trap is about to fire when he steps on it. If he knew the trap was going to fire, he would not step on it to start with, I promise you. But with that surprise, he does not feel. By the time he steps on a pan hard enough to mash it down to actually fire it, and if he mashes it down enough to fire, and he in a nanosecond hears the noise of the fire that the firing trap makes, he the traps go to something completely crazy under his foot, i.e. firing, jaws are coming up, he has no time to pull his foot back. His brain cannot work that fast. He doesn't have time for his nervous system to send electrical impulses from his brain and from his foot and his, you know, feeling in his foot through his body to his brain, even from his ears to his brain, and then back to his foot to fire his muscles to retrieve his foot from that. He doesn't have enough time to do all that before the trap is closed on him. That's what makes a trap work. It's an element of surprise when he steps on it. So it's kind of a cool little example. You may want a quarter from your buddy, and at the same time, it kind of illustrates what's happening as this trap's firing. So to get back on point a little bit, you know, the animal's effectively caught in the midair, you know, when the trap fires. So, excuse me, let me grab a glass of water again. So effectively, understanding that is, I think our kill area is certainly bigger than the original pan, because our pan our expanded pan is bigger than the original pan. But I'm convinced that the kill area of a trap that's modified with an expanded pan is even bigger than the diameter of the expanded pan. Now, how do I get there? How can I make a claim that the kill area is bigger than the pan itself? Well, what I'm saying is, just say you had a 6-inch round expanded pan. He stepped half on, half off the trap, but was the front toes were far enough away. So the center of his pad may have been half inch away. Well, that's still kill area. Even though he stepped half inch away from the pan, his toes still initiated that pan and engaged it. It tripped the trigger of the trap, and it fired and caught him. So if you kind of want to go down that lane, it actually expands the kill area even bigger than the pan itself, because you can fire it from without having to be directly on top of it. So now, speaking of the expanded pan of the kill or fire area, I'll go into a little bit about expanded pan and kind of what we do. And here again, for risk of sounding like an infomercial, I'm not here trying to exclusively plug expanded pan, but I do want to explain how we got here a lot, because I think it makes a lot of sense, and just from makes sense for in light of the big pan issue and trying to explain why we're going to the big pans and what the advantages are of going to those big pans. So what we're doing with expanded pan, we're making expanded trap pans for 11 different of what we feel like are the most popular traps out there. Now I'll go on and name them real quick, just so folks know what we make and what we don't make. Currently, we currently make pans for Bridger number 2's, Doggone and Dogless, Bridger number 3's, Doggone and Dogless, Duke 4's, we make pans for Sleepy Creek Long Spring number 3's, for TS-85's, CDR's, Montana 3's, and MB-550's. In addition to that, we also make expander pans for 220 body grips, and we use those in our boxes or our cubby sets, just to kind of give you a few examples of how we use those 220s, and they don't think are on the website yet, but they'll be coming soon. So to give you an example of what we're doing, MB550 is super popular. It's probably our best-selling pan right now. A stock pan of an MB550 measures 5.71 square inches. 5.71. That's the square inch area of a MB550. If you order it and it comes out of the box and you measure it, that's what it comes to. With our expander pans that we're welding on, that our MB550 is a weld-on pan. Ours, it measures 11.331 square inches. So we go from 5.71 to 11.33 square inches. So that's a 219% of the original pan surface area. Also, in comparison, just grab a big trap, say like a CDR. CDR pan measures 7.581 square inches, 7.581, and the expander pan, replacement pan for the CDR measures 29.710. So 7.581 up to 29.710 square inches. That increases the size just 392%. As a matter of fact, of the original pan area. So, and actually, across all those pans, all those traps that I mentioned that we make pans for, our average increase percentage-wise in square inches of the original pan's dimensions to the replacement pans across all those models averages almost 300% is our average from all the, you know, all the Bridgers and they all vary some, but they average, if you add all those up and divide them by the number, they average around 300% larger than the original pans that were putting on there, or 300% the original pan size. So that should give the trapper a real and measurable advantage to increase his production with one single modification. And so, speaking of modifications, one thing we wanted to do when we started expander pan was to make these modifications, or swapping the original pan for the new expander pan. And I say this here again, I'm not just plugging expander pan, this is just what we're doing. But we wanted to make that transition very, very easy and user friendly. And on most of the models that we do, we had that whole idea when we started. We wanted our name to be easy, to fast, simple, and reliable. We wanted the traps to fire every single time, but we also wanted it easy for a trapper to be able to swap these. So most of the models that we produce, installation is as simple as simply removing your existing pan bolt from your trap, setting the stock pan aside, replacing it with expander pan. That is it. You know, tighten your bolt back up to your desired pan tension and you are done. You know, that is as simple as it gets, and that was kind of our goal. Understanding that early on, we also found that as we were trying to make all these things, and we've got some really precision equipment, we can make almost every single one of our expander pans identical. But we found we still had a problem. We found the manufacturers of these traps had a lot of inconsistencies in their designs, even from trap to trap out of a box of the same dozen. We found that they were. The tolerances were not exact, from trap to trap, even out of the same box. What I'm trying to say is, if you imagine the pan stand there, if you had 1/64th of an inch, say, between your left pan stand where the pan bolt goes through, where your trap pan attaches to, and from the left to the right, even if it was 1/64th of an inch off, or double that area, if it was 1/128th of an inch off, you may or may not notice that. You probably would if you look super close to original pan that only covers, you know, the center, say 1/3 of that trap. But when you go way out away from the pan stand, or the point of pivot there, and you get way out, you kind of create what you would call a fulcrum effect, and that error is pronounced, is exaggerated greatly the further away that you get from that pivot point. So we found that because of these inconsistencies, that a lot of times, even though we're making a very homozygous product, a product that was, one's just like the next one's just like the next one, there were still inconsistencies when you bolted on the trap. Not much, but enough that you, if you look closely, you could see maybe the pan was a little high on the front or a little high on the back or a little tilted to the left or a little tilted to the right. And on closer examination, we found almost every case, it was very, very ever so slight inconsistencies in the trap. And so that kind of led us to you know, what do we want to make the traps out of? We got to have something that's easy to adjust, because we want it so easy that we still like the idea of just sticking a bolt through there. Now I've got an expander pan on. It's as easy as pulling the bolt out, throwing the old pan away, putting the expander pan on, tightening the bolt back. Now I'm done. Well, now if I got it sitting slightly unlevel, I need a quick and easy way to adjust this, even a quick and easy way to adjust it in the field. So that's what we started playing with, was the thicknesses of metal, and we started trying this just through trial and error and making sure that everything fit just exactly right. Our tolerances were super critical. That's one thing that we really found early on is our tolerances around the outside jaws had to be perfect. We kind of stumbled across a magic formula there that works on most traps. Some we can kind of tweak and get by with a little different numbers than we can others, but every trap has a certain tolerance that you can't get too close to the jaws, and we try to fill up every bit of that area as we can. We found that if the tolerances, and when I'm saying tolerances, I'm talking about the width of this expanded pan, how close it comes to the inside jaws of your trap. If it was too tight, the pan would not allow the trap to fire. It'd literally get in the way. If it's too loose, you're leaving fireable areas, we like to call it, on the table. You could have more pan there. So through trial and error, and I have a picture of our scrap pile at one time when we were trying to develop these, or our reject pile, I call it a scrap pile. And it's almost 3 feet tall, the picture of that pile of scrap pans were. And what we'd do, we'd cut a pan, we'd put it on there, we'd see the flaw in the design, we'd toss it in the scrap pile, correct that issue, and we'd start over. We'd find another issue, and we'd correct that, and we started. So all these have really been trial and error, and we just would not give up until we had it exactly perfect. And once we had it perfect, that's when we had the saved design. So these are all computer saved designs. So my machine will cut them and manufacture them identical once I have that saved design. And so that's protected to the nth degree, so we don't have to go through that again. And once I have the saved design, it'll work from now on. So long as the manufacturers don't change the trap, it'll bolt on mine, it'll bolt on yours, it'll bolt on every of the same model trap that's made for that particular model and size of trap. So because we got those saved, we can come back with almost 100% accuracy on every pan once we have it saved. Another real important feature here and thing that people need to realize about any expanded pans, whether it's mine or whether it's a homemade knockout or it's one of our competitions, these things have to be mounted on square every time. And I want to use kind of a little analogy to help understand that. Sometimes the way my brain works is, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I've got to kind of let my brain exaggerate things. So here's my example. In other words, for simplification, imagine a rectangle jaw trap that the jaws are exactly 3 inches wide and 4 inches long. That's what, when you open this trap and set it, that's what our imaginary trap is going to be. It's going to be exactly 3x4. And so for my little hypothetical example, I'm going to make a replacement pan for that trap that's going to be 2.5 inches by 3.5. I'm going to have a half inch all the way around the inside jaws, basically between the, as the trap is set, between the inside jaws of the trap and the outside of my pan, I'm going to have a half inch all the way around. So to draw this exaggerated picture, imagine that you took this 2.5 by 3.5 inch pan and mounted it at a 45 degree angle to the inside of that 3x4 jaw. And that would never work. If you could have some way to secure that on the hinge or on the pan stands or where your pan bolt goes, but it's at a 45 degree angle. There's no way that trap would ever fire because every single corner is going to be sticking over the jaws of the trap. Now that's way oversimplified and way more error, gross error than what you do. But if you can imagine the gross error, and then you know you kind of divide that by 1,000, that's what we were finding. That's where the tolerances become so important and why it is so important that that pan goes on square. So what we do is we go to pains to make sure that these from the manufacturing steps that we have this thing on square. And we've also got videos up on our YouTube our website that shows how we adjust these if they happen to be slightly off square. So it's really important to have them square, and when you have them installed properly, and that's just almost the responsibility of the trapper to have them installed properly and square to the trap, where the tolerance or the empty area between the outside of the pan and the inside jaws of the trap is the same all the way around. And when they are there, they work and they fire true, and they fire every time. So having it 100% square is hugely important. I've got some notes here. I'm kind of trying to vaguely follow, and I've been wondering a little bit, so just kind of looking here at the next thing. The next issue we found was pan tension and how we were going to adjust that. So I mentioned that one of our goals was to make bolt-on pans for every time we can. Now there are some traps that bolt-on pans just will not work. The 550 is a great example of that. The way that MB550 is made, great trap. I love the trap. I've got, I don't know, 2 or 3 dozen that I catch cavities in every year. Still use the trap. I like the jaws a lot on it. It's a good functional trap, good trap for a lot of different critters, coons to coyotes. It's real versatile. But it does not carry a pan bolt. They start with a pan, their manufacturing process, I assume, but almost have to. The spring keeper goes through there, then they install the springs, apparently, and then they bend those spring keepers at 90 degrees, and so your pans are basically riding on there. They stabilize their pan some with their latching system. I like the trap, it's a great latching system, but there's no way to take a bolt out because there's not a bolt that exists there and rebolt and expand a pan to it. There's just no way to do it. So for that particular trap, we manufacture a weld-on trap pan for that, and that's become one of our best sellers, probably because that trap is so popular and it is so versatile and such a good trap. Well, to avoid to get back to our square issue and how important it is to square, what we do on ours is we put some inspection holes there. There's some landmarks on the original trap pans there that our inspection holes go right over. There's actually 4 of them. Those inspection holes serve 2 purposes. One, they help you line that pan up with the expander pan up with the existing pan exactly the same. Once you're seeing those 4 landmarks, that trap has to be square of the pan. You can put a pair of vice grips on it right there. Now those inspection holes also become spot weld holes. You can weld right over those spots. You know 100% of the time that trap is exactly right. And early on, we made a lot of weld-on pans, and what we found an issue with those too. And the issue came, sometimes it can be an issue, sometimes it's not an issue, but it just depends. What we found was the heavier we got, with the bigger the traps are, and this is especially true of large traps, say like your CDRs, like your TS85s, like your big number 3 traps, a lot of them, even in some cases a bigger panned number 2 traps. You got this fulcrum effect. If we had strictly a weld-on pan and our target animals, this is very, very important, our target animals were light animals. They were, say, like mink, small coons. I was recently in Maine, I saw a weasel. If all weasels are the size of the little weasel that I saw, that'd be the case there. But very small, light animals that you would have to run super light pan tension on, if that's what you're shooting at, then you need to run light pan tension. And with the, and so now we got to talk about weight of the trap and what we can get by with super light pan tension. You almost need a free falling trap pan to do that. And essentially, with a weld on, you have two pans sitting there. You have the original pan, then you weld on another slab of metal, which is the expanded pan, and you increase that weight. Now, with the bigger trap pans, the further away you get from that pivot point or where the bolt is, or where the hinge point is, the heavier things get. Imagine like a seesaw on a playground, the same kind of thing, it's a fulcrum effect. And so with a heavier weight all the way out there, we found it difficult to run light pan tension. Not an issue for us when we're focused on coyotes. We run heavy pan tension on our coyotes anyway. And the extra weight is a non-issue for me because I'm targeting big animals. We're shooting at, you know, 18 to 30, 40 pound coyotes or bigger. I mean, a lot of times bigger. So, you know, the bigger animals, I can run a pretty heavy pan tension on there. It's enough to hold up anything. So it really depends on what you're doing. But I just be careful. If you're shooting at small animals, be careful with a heavy, heavy weight when you're doubling up your pans. Basically, when you're doing a weld on, you got the weight of two pans. Keep that in mind because that's something that, you know, that could, you know, you're not have enough tension on there to keep that trap set. And so that's kind of something we found. I thought I'd throw that out there for you to consider if you're a small animal trapper and you have needs to run light pan tension. Here again, if you do and you can get by even with the animal that you're targeting with the heavier pan tension, that's one solution. The other solution is to get rid of your original pan and go with one pan, go with a larger pan. What we found, doubling the weight a lot of times was the limit. You know, if you had the weight of the original pan and a half, you could get by. But when you doubled or more than doubled the weight out there, that's when you started getting in trouble. So I wanted to kind of throw that out there. And like I said, it's not a big issue at all if you're targeting heavy animals and running heavier pan tension. So I've already covered the another trap that we manufacture that's also weld on only is the Montgomery. Very similar with those Montgomerys. They're real popular trap for a lot of live market coyote guys. Super trap. I got a lot of buddies that use those a lot. Great trap, but they also attach very similar to the way the 550 original pans attach. They don't bolt on or bolt off. So if you're a 550 guy, girl, or a Montgomery trapper, then you know you're gonna have to be thinking about welding those on if you're gonna go to expanded pans on those style traps. So just kind of scanning back through my notes and making sure that I've covered what I wanted to cover, talking about the big pans. Some of the things that we have found, and this is a real interesting point here, I had a customer that ordered some pans from me for a couple of weeks ago. He was trapping big critters. He was trapping coyotes primarily. He also targeted a few great big coons. This guy is Chris from Ohio. Chris is probably listening to the show right now, so shout out to Chris. He ordered several dozen pans from me for Bridger number twos. He actually started with a dozen. He liked what he was doing with them, and he was telling me that he was kind of changing things up a little bit. He was taking all my hard work from where I was bending the ears down so the expanded pans would bolt right on his Bridger number twos, and there's a lot of work goes into that and a lot of precision bending and some equipment that we built ourselves to take care of the precise bends there. And he was taking a torch and he was cutting those off and he was welding those pans on. He loved the way that they fit inside the jaws when the trap was open, but he really liked the pit system that they're for the night latch that Bridger runs on their traps. He liked it so much he wanted to keep that, and we do have an inspection hole there that lets you see where the dog is, or even on a dogless design like a Bridger 2, you can see where your jaw is in relation to the trigger point on the pan, but it's not a night latch though. He liked to hear the click, and I kind of like to hear the click on some of those. I like that pit system. It's a pretty cool system. They've got that figured out. So what he was doing essentially was taking our bolt on Bridger 2 expander pans, and he was cutting off the ears and welding them on. So I told him, man, we had not we were selling a lot of the 550s, and I said, well, let me see if I can't do the same thing with the 550s. So I did that, and it really worked for them. So we're actually going to add that line. We're going to add weld-on pans, even for the Bridger number twos. And here again, you just got to keep in mind that it's going to be for heavy animals. That's what you got to bear in mind. That's where what you got to target when we're looking at those. But he really liked the night light latch system, so he ordered them. We can build a pan for any trap on the market. Sometimes we got to have the trap in, you know, one example, the trap in hand to do the design with. But, you know, we can custom and tailor them, and that's what we're about as a company, is making what the customer wants. So we learned something from Chris in Ohio, and I thank you, buddy, for showing us that. And we're actually going to add those to our line of trap pans this year. So we'll have pictures of those here shortly on the website as well, and we'll be making them. So if you like the night light system, we can do without the bolt on. We can make a weld on for those too. It really just depends on what your goals are and what you want and what you're targeting. Certain things work for certain animals and certain things won't, as we've talked about. So the most important thing though that you got to keep in mind is on those weld-on pans, you got to get them squared up and straight, and that is so critical. I just caution folks there, because without the bolts to bolt them on, if you're just having them on there, the square part is you do have the ability to fine-tune them some, but you just cannot get them grossly out of lines with the holes that, you know, like what we do on our 550s with the lineup holes. You got to be square on those on the installation process. So with that, that's kind of what I had to talk to you about. There's several issues, several things we found with expanded pans and expand A pans, and kind of how we got there and how that'll benefit you. I hope this helped you. If you're thinking about the going to the big pans, we'd love to help you. But more importantly, I think it's something, regardless if you get mine or somebody else's, I think it's something that's going to put an advantage in your corner, the trapper's corner, to help you catch more fur and put more fur in their fur shed. We do some other things besides expanded pans. We make several tools there. Most of those are listed on the website there. We make a pretty cool little snare chaser that I'm not going to go into, but pictures of it are there. We make some pretty cool lure holders that are that kind of keep your lure wet if it's, you're in a rainy period. Work great at flat sets, keep your weather out of the sun and also out of the rain, keeping from washing away or breaking down the sun. But those are all listed there. We got several products that we make. We also make a lot of signage and decorative items, light switch covers, all trapping related. So all those things are listed there, and I'm not gonna plug those anymore. But all of stuff is there. But like I said, guys, I just really wanted to kind of cover the big pans. That's my expertise. That's what I've done a lot of work on, a lot of research on. I wanted to explain that. I appreciate you listening tonight. I'm sorry for bumbling around. I know I don't do as good of a job as Clint does, but I'm glad to help. I appreciate the opportunity Clint gives me to host. I really enjoy talking to you guys and meeting you. I appreciate that a bunch. Looking forward to next week. We're going to have a super good interview if I can get everything pulled off. I think I've got it lined up, and so I'm looking forward to that. Until next week, guys, get out there. It's time to be getting your traps ready, getting the rust knocked off of them. If you're a boil and die guy, it's time to be getting that done. Trapping season will be here before you know it. Convention season is here out there now. Get out there, guys. Learn something. Have a good week. We'll see you next week right back here on Trapping Radio. Look forward to being with you then.